It's Weekend on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Laura Sullivan. And Herman Cain continues to garner public attention for allegations of sexual harassment.
That's kind of what happens when you start to show up near or at the top of the polls. It just happens that way.
That was Cain yesterday speaking before the conservative group Americans for Prosperity. James Fallows of The Atlantic joins us as he does most Saturdays for a look behind the headlines. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Laura.
Herman Cain was received quite warmly at that event. NPR's Andrea Seabrook was there, and she reports that she found a couple people troubled by the charges, but overwhelmingly support for Cain was very strong.
Of course, we don't know the full truth of these allegations about Herman Cain or how it will affect his political campaign in the long run. We do know, however, that at least in the first couple of days of this story, it seems to have strengthened as opposed to rapidly weakened his political support. And I think that underscores something that's quite unusual about this Republican primary race compared to any in either party I can think of over the last almost 50 years. And what I mean is we have a contrast in the party between a candidate whose main argument is his alleged electability, that is Mitt Romney, who says he's governed in a Democratic state, et cetera, and a candidate, a series of candidates whose main appeal is that they reflect what the party and its most conservative members really stand for. We had Rick Perry in this role, we had Michelle Bachmann, and now Herman Cain. And really, the last time I remember this stark a contrast was in 1964, when it was Barry Goldwater who eventually won the nomination against Nelson Rockefeller. So that's what's striking about this race right now.
Well, let's turn now from politics to Afghanistan, where a senior military officer lost his job this week after making rather blunt public statements about Afghan President Hamid Karzai. Karzai went out and said that he would support Pakistan in a war against the United States. And this Major General, Peter Fuller, said, look, we've spent billions of dollars on your country and lost American lives. And he wasn't mincing words.
He was not. And I think we've seen illustrated here a point about the military and maybe a larger point about the U.S. strategic position both with Afghanistan and with Pakistan. The point about the military, of course, is that uniformed officers are subject to civilian control. They're not supposed to express big political views, especially controversial ones, even though over the last decade or so, military officers have done a lot of the diplomacy in dealing with that part of the world and often are quite sophisticated in their understanding of the human and political forces there. Still, they can't say those things, and Major General Fuller is the latest person to be reminded of that fact. The larger point, however, is that the frustration that General Fuller expressed here is similar to sentiments we've heard both from diplomats and quietly from American military people about dealing with Afghanistan and Pakistan, two countries whose governments are very problematic for the U.S. to deal with, and yet two states the United States absolutely needs to deal with in trying to contain various long-term threats from that part of the world. So I think we saw a soldier who got in trouble for doing what soldiers are not always supposed to do, which is to tell the truth about political realities.
Well, we just can't end today without talking about 60 Minutes commentator Andy Rooney, who died yesterday at the age of 92.
I think it's important for NPR listeners to think of Andy Rooney in the same category as Daniel Shore, who, of course, meant so much to this network over the years, in that both of them were part of this great generation of the so-called Murrow Boys, the people who were acolytes of Edward R. Murrow at CBS News, and had this distinguished reputation and achievement for how broadcast could illuminate the world. People naturally think that about Daniel Shore and some other people from that heritage. They're less likely to remember that about Andy Rooney, because in recent decades he's had more of sort of a curmudgeon role in his 60 Minutes essays. But he was part of a really distinguished tradition in American news, and I think in the long run he will be seen that way.
It really does. I mean, it feels like the end of an era.
It does, and it is.
James Fallows is national correspondent with The Atlantic, and you can read his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Laura.
When Jerusalem fell in 70 AD, a group of Jews journeyed through the desert and settled in a place called Masada. It's an ancient fortress atop an enormous rock plateau, surrounded by steep cliffs in what is now southern Israel.
Although it was said that Masada could never fall, and that God had made this mountain for the purpose of our rebellion, I wondered how long we could endure a siege should the Romans come. The storerooms of the king could not sustain us forever. Herod's oil and wine and lentils had fed us, but they were no more. Now the rats ruled the storerooms. It was rumored they had been brought here by the Romans, purposely left behind, in case our people, ever took back this fortress, so they might bring us disaster, devouring what little we had left.
That's author Alice Hoffman reading from her new book, The Dove Keepers. Hoffman has written almost 30 novels, and many have been compared to modern-day fairy tales. The Dove Keepers is her first foray into fiction with a historic backdrop. This book follows four women and their fight to survive after the fall of Jerusalem. Alice Hoffman joins me in our Washington, D.C. studio. Alice, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you.
In your research for this book, I understand you visited the Masada excavation site in Israel. Did you know when you went there that you were going to write a book about what you saw there, or did it come to you when you were there?
It came to me when I was there. I felt so moved and so connected. And then when I got home, I started to read about Masada, and I read Josephus's account. It's the only account of the fortress, and he said that two women and five children survived, and they were the ones who told the story to the Romans and to the rest of the world. And as soon as I heard that, I felt that I'd found my novel.
Now, this is the first time that you've really based one of your novels in a historical event.
Yes, it is. I've written teen novels that are historical novels. I wrote one about the Inquisition, and I wrote another one that took place during the Bronze Age. But this was a huge undertaking, and I had never done anything like this.
Was it hard to do the research? I mean, was it a new experience in a lot of ways?
Well, it was really difficult for me because, you know, I'm not a historian. I've been a visiting scholar at Brandeis, but I'm not a historian. And what was really interesting is that there's almost nothing about women in the ancient world. There are no stories. So in a way, that was very freeing for me to use archaeological evidence and create my own stories.
What kind of research did you do to put this book together?
Well, I did a lot of reading, and I really used a lot of archaeological evidence. I think one of the reasons is my son is an archaeology student, so I was pulled into that arena. And many, many of the things that are in the book are artifacts that are found in the Masada Museum. For instance, there's a tartan plaid fabric that belongs to one of the characters in The Dove Keeper. There's also the hair and shoes of a character. When I saw the artifacts that belong to the real people who live there, you know, the makeup palettes, the amulets, the shoes, it really felt alive to me.
When you go through the process of developing these characters, which are all four very strong women, how do you find four such distinct personalities and keep them all separate in your own mind?
Well, they felt very, very separate to me. And it was only after I finished writing the book that I really realized that they really all are parts of me, that if I divided myself into quarters, it would be these four women.
Even the witch?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
One of those four characters was Revka, mm-hmm. who just had been through an extraordinary amount of trauma. Tell me about her.
Well, she's kind of the older, wise woman of the group who leads a perfectly normal life for the time, and then a tragedy comes to her, as it does to most of us at some point. And she loses both her husband and her daughter, and her whole world is shaken, her whole belief system, her faith, everything. The only really reason that she survives is because she has grandchildren, and there's no one to take care of them but her.
I mean, her daughter died a horrible death, and her children for a long time couldn't speak because of it. Was it hard to write about that kind of torture and trauma?
It was very hard to write about it. And, you know, the funny thing for me, beginning a book about Masada was the first time I knew, in a way, what the ending was going to be. Mm. I knew 900 Jews would commit mass suicide. And for me, I had to find the hope within that, the inside story. And I think I did that with these women.
I'm speaking with Alice Hoffman about her new book, The Dove Keepers. It tells the story of four women fighting for their lives after the fall of Jerusalem. Aziza was raised as a boy, and then she became a very skilled fighter in the book. What was your inspiration for her?
Well, you know, I actually think I've been thinking about this for a long time because I had written a book about colonial Massachusetts. And when I read about people signing up for Massachusetts for the Civil War, I read about a lot of women who would disguise themselves as men and go to war, sometimes to take the place of a man. And I've been thinking a lot about women as warriors. So it just was a natural progression to write about that in The Dove Keepers.
well, there isn't a lot of historical document that we would have of women being such heroic fighters and skilled fighters. And it could have been possible.
It could have been
possible.
But
we simply just don't know. And it's certainly not what we're all steeped in, the knowledge. We always have this vision of the men fighting, especially during this time period.
Right. And that's so true that the stories didn't come down to us. You know, one of the books that I wrote for teens called The Foretelling that takes place in the Bronze Age is about a group of women warriors based on archaeological finds. Again, these women were found in caves buried with their weapons and their horses. So what the true story of women as warriors really is very difficult to know.
Each of the women in this book have been hurt in some significant way. But they all seem to find a sense of solace in Masada with each other and coming together. And even in the end, even though the end is not necessarily a happy ending, did you intend to do that?
You know, I think very often a writer doesn't know what she intends to do. And I think that there's an outside story and an inside story. Mm. And as I was writing, I think I discovered the inside story was all about forgiveness and the ability to forgive, which I find very difficult to do. But I think that's really at the core of all of these women's stories.
So you've written almost 30 books so far. You must be writing these very fast.
I am a fast writer. I go over my writing. I write lots of different drafts, but my initial draft usually is very fast. And I think that's because when I started out, I had a short story published and a very famous editor wrote to me and asked me if I had a novel. And I wrote back that day and said, yes, I do. And I started writing. And I wrote as fast as I could. And in 6 months, I had a novel to send to him.
Wow.
So I think that was my early training.
And then you go back and it sounds like you're taking an axe to the original draft, not a scalpel.
An axe. I really believe that. I really believe that sometimes you have to get rid of the parts that you love the best about a book.
That's Alice Hoffman, author of the new novel, The Dove Keepers, and she joined me here in our Washington, D.C. studio. Alice, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon, and we're going to take a closer look now at yesterday's unemployment report. The official unemployment rate fell in October, but just slightly, from 9.1% to 9%. Business growth was modest, but state and local governments continued to shed jobs. We're joined now by NPR's business correspondent, Yuki Noguchi. Yuki, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Would you put the headline, good news or bad news, on this?
Well, to paraphrase one analyst, it's neither cause to celebrate nor to disappoint. The good news part of this is that businesses are hiring. Things are not moving backward. And actually in better numbers than what we had initially thought for August and September. And in general, the numbers are sort of trending the right way. The number of long-term unemployed is actually down in October, and so are the number of people who are looking for more work. But in the larger context of what's going on in the labor market, these are very minor changes. The number of people on business and government payroll increased by 80,000 in October. If you think about it, the number of people who are unemployed or looking for more work is 200 times that. So it's a fairly minor change.
Enough of a change to begin to suggest a trend?
Well, it's hard to say what's going to come up in the next couple of months. A lot of that will depend on whether there are additional outside shocks. I mean, you're looking at Europe, which is still grappling with its debt problems without a clear resolution at this point. And, you know, you've got things like the Congressional Super Committee that are trying to come up with ways to cut the deficit. And these are all sort of uncertainties that make employers hang back and not hire. And then this week, you also saw the Federal Reserve revised downward its anticipated economic growth forecast. So now it's saying that the unemployment level will remain above 8% into 2013. So that's certainly not a sign that we're going to come out of this anytime soon.
What are the chances that a really solid season of holiday spending can have an impact on the economy?
Well, you know, spending is very important, and it drives two-thirds of all of economic growth. So that could create a reason for businesses to hire. But in order to do that, the spending would actually have to stick. In other words, it couldn't just sort of come and then pull back. It would have to continue to grow for businesses to hire beyond the seasonal hiring that you talked about around the holidays. Although recently you've seen consumer spending increase a bit, consumer confidence remains very, very low.
And let me ask you about some of the political implications about the Labor Department unemployment report. President Obama's been trying to get his American Jobs Act passed by Congress. The bill failed again in the Senate this week.
So politically, the question is, does this report advance President Obama's case for the American Jobs Act? And he certainly hopes that's the case. Here's a clip of him speaking yesterday at the G20 summit in Cannes, France.
Yeah, my hope is that the folks back home, including those in the United States Senate and the House of Representatives, when they look at today's job numbers, which were positive, but indicate once again that the economy is growing way too slow, that they think twice before they vote no again on the only proposal out there right now that independent economists say would actually make a dent in unemployment right now.
But Republicans dismiss the proposal as just another stimulus and one that probably won't work. And they also object to the proposed increase in taxes for the very wealthy that is part of the proposal to pay for it.
Republicans, as a generalization, believe that would discourage hiring.
Correct.
NPR's Yuki Noguchi, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
Tonight, like most Saturday nights in college towns across the country, students are getting ready to party. And the one thing most of those parties will have in common, besides a few chilled kegs, is a large stack of cups, red plastic cups, to be precise. And just how did these big, bright liquid holders get so popular that folks are now singing about them? Producer Lauren Silverman volunteered to do some research.
That red cup is part of a legacy that stretches back 75 years. It's made by a company called Solo, from the folks that brought us those little paper cone cups at the water cooler and the wax-lined cups at fast food joints. But nothing has had the impact of the red Solo cup.
My first experience with the Solo cup, I'm guessing it was in high school at some kind of keg party we should not have been throwing.
That's Seth Stevenson. He's a reporter for Slate Magazine, an occasional beer drinker, and a major fan of country singer Toby Keith's new song.
Now, Red Solo Cup is the best receptacle for barbecues, tailgates, fairs, and festivals. And
okay, wait a second. I need to make it clear that Solo did not pay Toby Keith to write this song. Even scarier, he's just one of many who worship at the shrine of the Red Cup.
Actually, I've seen people use it as a to-go cup. One woman, I watched her make her scrambled eggs in the morning, and she put it in her cup, and she said, "This is how I go to work."
That's Kim Healy. She's vice president of Solo's consumer business department.
People make flowers out of these cups. We had someone that made a full lobster costume out of our cups, head to toe.
I love you, Red Solo Cup. I lift you up, proceed to party.
When I joined the company and saw how iconic the red party cup was, my first inclination was, well, then we shouldn't change anything about it.
But that's exactly what Kim Healy did in 2009, and it caught Seth Stevenson's eye.
One day I was walking through the grocery store and I noticed a subtle change, and the red Solo cup had square sides and a square bottom instead of the round one I was used to. And suddenly it occurred to me that the red Solo cup has been this ever-present item in my life since I was a teenager, and it had changed. It looks like a tank.
The shape changed, Kim Healy says, because people wanted something sturdier that wouldn't slip out of your hand when beer sloshes over the side.
You're more than just plastic. You're more than amazing. You're more than fantastic.
Now, plenty of other companies make disposable plastic cups, and a lot of them are cheaper than Solo's. But this is the one that's become king of the keggers.
It's just become synonymous with partying. And when people go to the store to stock up for their barbecue, that red Solo cup, it calls to them.
And now it sings.
Red Solo cup, I fill you up. Let's have a party.
Lauren Silverman, NPR News.
Six men in Moscow are readjusting to life on Earth today after enduring a long, simulated mission to Mars. They spent 520 days locked inside a fake spaceship. The hatch was opened yesterday. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports that this pretend trip involved real psychological challenges that may still persist.
Any future mission to Mars would most likely be international. So this crew had three members from Russia, one from China, and two from the European Space Agency, including Diego Urbina. Back in June of 2010, a little over a week into the fake voyage, he made a video tour of their new home. It was just a few bus-sized modules.
This is the living room where we spend a lot of our leisure time.
The small wood-paneled room had a rug, a TV for watching videos, a bookshelf, but no windows to look out at the warehouse they were in. Any contact with the outside was indirect, through video or email. Sometimes, to mimic a Mars mission, there'd be a 20-minute delay, or days with no communications at all.
Here we have an airlock to which we pass all the samples to scientists around the world.
Blood and urine samples, to test things like stress hormones. He made other video diaries, like one during a fake emergency that shut off the lights and ventilation.
Everything's very dark. We hope it won't be too long.
Other sources of stress? Boredom. Plus, no escape from seeing the same people day after day after day. The European Space Agency says the crew performed as a team with, quote, no significant conflicts.
But that doesn't mean that there weren't personal challenges.
Christian Otto is a physician who works with NASA to study the effects of long-duration missions.
I think the 520-day study went a remarkable way in mirroring what a long-duration space flight would be like. Is it 100%? No.
The crew couldn't float in microgravity. They didn't have the thrill of truly walking on Mars or the fear of real accidents. But just getting through it was an accomplishment. Otto has done year-long stints in Antarctica and says sensory and social isolation is powerful.
These experiences in isolation change us.
He says the psychological effects linger even after the isolation is over. The day before the hatch opened, Urbina reported on Twitter, quote, amazingly intense and very surreal hours, preparing to enter the most alien of worlds. He seemed to be referring not to Mars, but to the world outside his capsule, right here on Earth. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is NPR News. It's always tempting for Americans to look at problems in Europe and ask, what does that have to do with me? Well, U.S. banks hold almost $17 billion in Greek debt and billions more bought through European banks. Billions of dollars that Americans have saved for retirement, college, or that rainy day that may be now, are invested in Greece. But we might also remind ourselves why the euro and the European Union were created. The problems of Europe led to two world wars in the 20th century. America got involved in each. In August 1943, Jean Monnet, the young French economist who advised Churchill, Roosevelt, and De Gaulle, warned, there will be no peace in Europe if the states are reconstituted on the basis of national sovereignty. The countries of Europe are too small to guarantee their peoples the necessary prosperity and social development. The European states must constitute themselves into a federation. Monnet hoped that scores of countries with different languages, legal systems, and historic rivalries be too busy making money to make war. This delighted Americans who'd sent millions into those wars. Jean Monnet used to point out that the notion of European Union had been around since Roman times. But Europe had also seen millions flee for new lives in the United States. The U.S. used its industrial might and human treasure to resolve wars in Europe. Europeans knew how Americans moved around their country. They saw that while Americans can have sharp differences, since the U.S. Civil War, regional rivalries here flare mostly at football games. So in the 1950s, six Western European countries formed a common market for coal and steel so that historic enemies would find it hard to unilaterally produce bombs and bullets. The European Union was formed in 1993 when the Balkan Wars reminded European leaders how old rivalries in the heart of Europe could turn treacherous. New states in Eastern Europe were eager to jump onto the economic engine of a modern Europe. EU leaders thought giving them shares in a prosperous democratic entity would help them from slipping back into tyranny. So the euro was minted in 2002 in hopes that a common currency and free travel would send people as well as money across borders. Germans, French, Greeks, Spaniards, and Poles might begin to think of themselves as Europeans. They hoped the euro could help instill a new nationalism, not based on ethnicity, blood, or religion, but diversity, liberty, and history. that many people in Europe are trying to shore up isn't only a currency, but an idea that Americans might have a stake in, too. And you're listening to NPR News.